Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically possible at any one point. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look as ideas move from being unthinkable to plausible to policy and speak to the people who change what is possible in politics. Now, a sentiment is something that is between an idea and a feeling. For instance, you can't tell me what to do. Sentiments can be powerful since we feel them and politicians can stoke them with laws and words. And to talk about the influence of sentiment on politics, I'm joined by Brian Dougherty. Brian is the senior editor of Reason Magazine and author of books such as Radicals for Capitalism, This is Burning Man, and Dirty Pictures. Brian, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Tell me about a sentiment you think matters to politics.
I want to riff off the one that you used in the intro first, because it's a very positive one for libertarians. It's a sentiment that many people share, that sentiment, you can't tell me what to do. There's kind of a less personally aggressive way of putting it that I often use when I'm arguing with or talking to more progressive, arty people about libertarianism. I'll say, look, libertarianism is just the idea that we should try to figure out what is the smallest, most minimal amount of violence and the threat of violence that we have to use to keep the human social order running, right? And that sounds very appealing. And that actually sounds kind of open-hearted. You can't tell me what to do is appealing, but it's more personal and is more pugnacious. But both very libertarian sentiments, very widespread sentiments. So then you might ask, why do not we live in a more actively libertarian country? It's a fascinating
question.
Everyone
agrees we should minimize violence. Yeah.
Right.
Most people.
Yes. If I had an answer that I thought was completely well-founded and unarguable, you know, I'd be a president or something. I'd be more successful than I am. So I don't have an answer, but I will. We can play around with thinking of some answers. One is sentiments butt against each other, right? Since, as you said, they're not quite ideas. They're not quite always rational. People can hold sentiments that actually are in conflict, and they might not understand that. Like, there's a sentiment that I think the Trump era has really brought to the fore, even on what you would have considered like the American right, libertarian, you know, conservative, this world that normally was thought of as being skeptical of government action to a greater or lesser degree. But the sentiment that Trump has played on, which is to me, to my peaceful libertarian mind, a scary one, is this sentiment of anger and fear of the other, in this case, immigrants, illegal immigrants. And I think that that's the engine behind a lot of the more libertarianly frightening things that Trump is doing. You know, the troops in the street thing to fight crime is sort of a slightly different variant of the same thing, where the other in that case is people's sense of urban criminals, which I think is kind of, you know, rooted back in the 70s and 80s when violent street crime was actually an enormously larger problem than it is today. I think that fear of the other is a very driving sentiment right now, and it leads people to forget, of course, get back to you can't tell me what to do, right? There's a lot of people, you know, I wrote a book about Ron Paul when he was running for president in 2012, so I met a lot of people who kind of came into a libertarian-ish thing without ever really going through the libertarian movement as I have chronicled it. So they didn't have all of the sort of the basic grab bag of ideas and arguments that that a libertarian movement person might have. And they think of themselves, they tend to use the word liberty movement, you might have noticed, rather than libertarian. It's a, it's a distinction that I see has some meaning to them. I haven't, it's like the weird debate where Democrats feel insulted if you call it the Democrat Party instead of the Democratic Party. I really don't actually have a grasp about why that's such a thing, but it is funny that Republicans insist on doing it. So, like, they know it has some punch. So I think similarly, people who say that they are a liberty movement person as opposed to a libertarian movement person kind of means you have a little bit more of the Ron Paul thing. And Ron Paul was actually not nearly as bad on immigration as Donald Trump. In fact, in one of the debates, he actually in 2012, he actually spoke against the notion of a border wall with a sort of very libertarian reminder that, hey, that wall keeps us in. You know, if you can only get in and out where the government approves, like that, we're trapped in as much as they're trapped out. But Ron Paul is a libertarian oriented person who does believe that it's, you know, constitutionally appropriate for the federal government to have a role in border control, whereas there's some libertarians who would say they don't. And so there's a lot of people who think of themselves as liberty-minded, but because they see immigrants as outside the circle.
Sorry, Brian, you popped out for a second. Can you hear me yet? Brian, are you back?
To libertarianism in the Trump era, to my perspective.
All right, so you brought up a lot, and I want to cover a couple of things. But the first one I want to notice is that, like, sentiments have easy justification, whether it is let's work with in a society with minimal amount of violence, to the anger and fear of the other that you mentioned, to there's disorder and criminality that exists in the world. You can find support and evidence that all of those things are true. What? So is politics just playing up and denying these sentiments? Can't we do a little bit better? Can't we get more sophisticated than just reacting on these things?
I don't know. I hope we can. I don't feel like there's a lot of evidence that we can. I mean, you know, Brian Kaplan is an old friend of mine and a estimable libertarian economist and author. He wrote a great book called The Myth of the Rational Voter that I think really helped straighten me about why politics doesn't work to get to where a person who thinks he's thinking rationally is going to go, because most voters, for reasons that make perfect sense, don't have any problem with making terrible mistakes with their vote. One of the reasons is, you know, they're generally aware that their vote is not actually settling the matter. I mean, a lot of us act like we don't believe it, or will say that we don't believe it when we're trying to justify voting. But I think it is, you do understand when you're voting, most people, that, well, I'm expressing something here. I'm not actually going to be responsible for who wins or loses. So there's not a lot of cost involved. You know, in general, in politics, whatever government does, there's a lot of costs imposed on the people who the government is acting on. The costs to the people who are paying for it tend to feel kind of minimal. You know, the whole, you know, what's the slogan? The, you know, concentrated benefits, diffuse costs. That allows voters.
Raise your problem for all the issues, for most of the issues that I work on. It's a concentrated benefits, diffuse cost problem.
Yeah, and a lot of people understand rational ignorance, the notion that, well, it doesn't pay for you to know about this. The payoff for you knowing about it's not going to be enough. Kaplan does an argument for what he calls rational irrationality, where it, like, just makes sense for you to not care if your political choices make any sense, to actually understand, you know, what tariffs do, to actually understand the benefits and costs of government action. Most people have no need to understand it, so they don't. Then there's the whole question of the margin, right? Because in most national elections, especially, it's a tiny number, tiny comparatively. You know, it's always tens of thousands generally, or hundreds of thousands. You know, there's a margin in the middle who, if you shift, is going to shift Democratic or Republican. But of course, with our first past the post electoral strategy, it's always going to be one of those two big parties, and those two big parties have histories, and those two big parties have interests, and those two big parties have the people who act within them and finance them and influence what they believe. That is just naturally going to limit the range of things.
Yeah, let me stop you there and just to say, and those two big parties also have a bench of sentiments that they draw upon to help win elections, to help, you know, those candidates particularly win their primary campaigns. They're not always the same, but they're not always all that different either. Like, both As Brian mentioned in the rational voter, both parties dwell on outsider bias. Both parties dwell on anti-trade and anti-market bias.
Yes. With that on the table, it all seems even more hopeless, doesn't it? I still believe, you know, I wrote this history of the libertarian movement, Radicals for Capitalism. So I got really immersed in the early days. And this guy, Leonard Reed, who founded the Foundation for Economic Education, which still exists and is the first think tank's not quite the word, first educational institution that didn't actually have classes, that pushed what I think is recognizably late 20th century modern American libertarianism.
Although I would say my own history, one of my economics classes freshman year of college at Northwood University was a compilation of essays from Freeman, the Foundation for Economic Education's publication.
Yeah. And I don't know how much, you know, someone in their teens or 20s nowadays is coming across Reed. I mean, it's all out there on the internet. But anyway, Reed had an attitude that has stuck with me, and it's unsatisfying to people who want quick political change, that want to solve all the problems they see quickly. He's like, it's just a matter of educating one mind at a time. Like, we have to create a critical mass of people in this country who think like libertarians if we expect to see a libertarian country. And I think the size of that critical mass might be a little larger than you think. It has to, I think, be wider than that margin because of all the forces of funding and inertia and sentiment and history that kind of trap the government as being what it is. And I, as I probably hinted earlier, I'm not at all enthused about Donald Trump in any way, but I do see a thing about him that does enthuse people who really like, I need to see change. Is Trump seemed willing in a way that no other president in our lifetime has been to really just knock things down, to just really like, no, whatever, we're not doing that anymore. Which can be good if the things he's choosing not to do are good things. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. To me, in an overall judgment of Trump, is his authoritarian temperament and actions overwhelm any little, you know, program cutting on the margins. That's a judgment other people have made differently. I'm not sure where I was going with that conclusion.
All right. I'm going to bring up kind of two things, because you have I've noticed that you had two different views that are in conflict, but don't necessarily have to be. One of which is, this is just how people are. Sentiments are powerful. You're really not going to get people off of those base assumptions. The whole partisan world thrives on that kind of conflict. And then the other one, which is, it really shouldn't take that many people to think differently, deeper, or to unite around an alternative to make a difference in politics. Is that accurate? And which one do you side on?
When you remember, first of all, that the number of people who vote in elections can float as low as slightly above 50. Don't think it gets much above 60 lately. I don't remember what it was last time, but there's a vast number of Americans who don't vote at all. So first of all, you're just talking about voters. And the second of all, you're talking about, you know, for partisan change, you're talking about the difference between not enormously large numbers of people, but and what I think I said this earlier, the problem is with the American political system, it's going to be one of those two parties, right? There's not room for 10% or 15% attitude or sentiment or set of beliefs to completely change things. I don't think. I could be proven to be wrong. I'm not sure how to
square card or something.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying, and I'm trying to figure out how to tie it all together. I mean, I don't, you know, if I said sentiment is hard to change, that was loose, because as I just said in talking about Leonard Reed, minds can be changed. My mind was changed.
Millions of libertarians who exist in the world, whereas 15 years ago, everyone knew each other.
Right. It's possible that to become a libertarian, to be convinced by libertarian arguments, that you needed to have a core sentiment that made you amenable to that, right? That could well be true. As I get older, I start to feel in a way that it might be true, in which case the task is harder. I certainly do not feel I understand social psychology well enough to have a well-formed opinion about, well, here is, we actually understand how and why in childhood or in your relationship with your parents, as a Freudian might say, or in your relationship with the public schools, that your set of political beliefs are formed. If anyone out there feels they know that for sure, maybe someone does, I'm not that person. So I do fall back on the Leonard Reed thing, if we are talking about, like, what's the hope for changing dominant sentiment, that you just educate. That's the only way I know of to do it. And it's possible, again, to tie in the two ideas, that it's harder than I think because there are these core sentiments that are beyond reason, that are beyond rational argument, that prevent people from changing. And regardless, even if I were convinced, if someone was like, you know, this whole libertarian project is not going to work. You're never in the American political system as we live in it going to get the federal government to behave in a recognizably libertarian way across the board. Even if I were completely convinced that were true, I would still think it's an interesting and useful thing to keep chipping around the edges with education and why liberty is good and why liberty leads to prosperity and why liberty can lead to joy and why liberty can lead to variety and all of the things that I think there's something about liberty as libertarians conceive it that is going to have some appeal to someone on some level. But the problem is, you know, I use this example a lot. You can get someone to agree in the minimizing of violence and social order. But then when you say, and so one of the corollaries of that, as I see it, is that we should eliminate, you know, the Food and Drug Administration or whatever, some crazy libertarian idea. Somehow along the way, most people don't get to where libertarians get. And libertarians like to believe, well, they're not exposed enough to our arguments. We're locked out of the media. Our candidates and thinkers are ignored. Certainly in the podcast age, you know, all those barriers are gone, right? There's no central little notch of media deciders who control what anyone thinks. There's certainly a lot of pro-liberty messaging out there, a lot of pro-liberty messaging that reaches enormous amounts of people. And that's encouraging. How it's going to end up translating into a government that does the right thing is still beyond me, because it's distressing, as I've said before, that I'm willing to just knock things down and close down government programs attitude in Trump and in the Trump administration is also melded to this obsession with, you know, troops in the street and, you know, kidnapping immigrants wherever you can find them. And that's like, you just, that can't be tolerated, you know. It's just, that's just no to that. So I'm
glad you brought this up, because you are, in fact, doing something to try and win people's hearts and minds. Like, this is, as far as I know, it's one of the reasons why Reason Magazine exists, is to get people exposed and to show them interesting things that libertarians might care about, I guess. I don't know. What is your record? What are you trying to do with that? And how do you use sentiments in your daily job?
Reason is an explicitly libertarian organization with an explicit goal of exploring, spreading, convincing about libertarian ideas. Reason does it through the realm of a political opinion commentary magazine. So we try not to be on the sort of research paper end. We try to do journalism that's engaging. We
gotta have some market for me,
right? I am not part of this part of Reason, but we are certainly pivoting enormously toward the podcast model, to the video model, to ways of receiving information that clearly resonate better with people under 35, probably. Luckily, there's still room for people who like to write, you know, 5,000 word magazine features, because that's more my speed. So information, storytelling, sympathetic characters, the basic idea that liberty, is
is kind of groovy, that liberty creates oral of plenitude, oral of choices, that is just kind of a better world for most people to live in. And that's the driving impetus behind what we do. Sort of the interests of the specific people who work there frame things in certain ways. Like we have CJ Sierra Mella, who loves criminal justice, you know, so he does a lot of great stuff on criminal justice. Eric Baum really loves understanding trade and international trade, does a lot of stuff on trade. Elizabeth Nolan Brown, who's really interested in issues involving women, which can range from natalism, pro and anti-natalist arguments, to sex trafficking. It's funny to say pro-sex trafficking, but in a way, that's why they use that term. You know, you just call it prostitution. No, it's just, yeah, should people have the right to do a financial transaction that involves their bodies? A libertarian would say yes. The sentiment of those things.
Check out their work. You would be interested in the case that they make for this kind of things.
Right. Isn't it fine to let people make choices about their life that are not in a direct and obvious way? Don't sort of specify it the way I specify it. Then you fall into the morass, like the anti-free speech stuff, where people are like, oh, well, the hawk is harmful to the, you know, to the marginalized community that it's aimed at or that ends. And so you got to be very specific about what harms are worth consideration. And to a libertarian, there would be harms that actually directly, physically harm you or your property, and not your property values, right? Because the whole thing of, oh, you can't paint your house that way. It affects, you know, the vibe of the whole street. And it's like, well, sorry, but like, this is my house. And unless I'm in an HOA where I've agreed to follow your rules, like, yes, I am free to commit the harm upon you of, you hate looking at my stupid house and you think my stupid house makes your stupid house worthless. It's like, okay, that's not an actionable harm. I've gone a little bit far there, but I do like to specify that, because I think when people hear the libertarian message just expressed, as long as you're not harming someone else, you really do have to get more specific about what harm means to a libertarian and what it ought to mean. So that's why I go off on that point.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned is overlying theme of the work for the magazine is to show that the libertarian world will be a better world. Part of that is understanding and trying to reach the sentiments of people who aren't libertarians. So what do you think helps with that?
What helps with that? I don't, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be in a better position than I am. I think the structure of a magazine is helpful because it's doing a bunch of different, and a web, you know, it's still a print magazine, but it's also a website. And every day on the website, there's going to be 4 to 7 new things up. So you provide a mix. You know, I think that's better than just like one guy in their Substack or a policy paper. It's like, here's a place where you're going to be exposed to commentary on the issues of the day, news stories about government doing stupid things that you might not know about or might not be thinking about, news stories about government messing up people's lives in ways that seem unjust. You know, that's a great libertarian classic. And I do think the concept of the magazine and the concept of the mix of perspectives and stories is a way in for people. And of course, what we don't know, or I don't know, I think we do have analysts in the back at Reason who do know this, is like, okay, someone tweets a link about something that some person, like, I'm not a libertarian at all, but I'm interested in someone's property being taken away from them for some dumb reason. I click on it. So you go to that, right? You see that. The way our webpage is set up, you do see a bunch of little teasy links to other things. I hope that leads to people reading other things. I don't personally know for sure that it does. Again, I'm sure we have analysts that do. I think that the smorgasbord quality of Reason and subject matter, slightly perspective, though we try to have a reasonably unified perspective, in favor of liberty, makes it a destination that people trust and enjoy. And we are doing, the numbers are fine. You know, they're never as much as you want them to be, but we continue to thrive in terms of the people reach our message and the people supporting our message. So I feel good about the product and the brand as a useful thing in the world, as a useful thing to readers and donors. When you ask, well, how does that translate into real world change? I don't know. The American political system makes that really, really hard for reasons we've hinted at or alluded to earlier. But it's always valuable to keep the message out there in whatever way you can.
I mean, we did have one of Reason founders, Bob Poole, on the podcast talking about his work changing transportation policy across America and across the world. But I think even he would be disappointed with it would be so much better if we got more, or if he had more of an influence.
Right. Yeah. Like airline and trucking deregulation happened in our lifetime. And it happened so long ago in my lifetime that I sometimes actually forget it as an example, because, you know, it happened 40 years ago. Absolutely libertarian victories. Bob Poole specifically was one of the great minds behind airport deregulation. Roads, you know, more road, pay roads, toll roads, great in a libertarian sense. You know, in the 21st century, what's happened with marijuana has been great. But there are big, the notion of foreign policy and libertarian effect on foreign policy is actually something really relevant now in an Overton window-y way. Again, it's difficult to directly attribute this to libertarians per se, but I think if you look at the history of the Republican Party in the last 20 years, you can't deny that Ron Paul had a big effect on it. And while we have not yet seen this change in sentiment actuated in Trump's actions sufficiently for me, it's undeniably true that your sort of modal Republican attitude toward foreign intervention is far more libertarian than it was 20 years ago. You'd be hard pressed finding a Republican who still wants to cheer the Bush era interventions. Even when Trump isn't being really anti-interventionist, his fans like to stress that, well, he wants to be, or he's more than he didn't start any new wars and all that, which is great. So that's, I think, an Overton window shift, at least within the Republicans. We'll see how it affects the Democrats the next time the Democrats run the federal government, if they were due. So that, I think, has been a reasonably clear-cut libertarian-ish victory in Overton window shifting, and I just want to see it actuated in more actual, less troops overseas, less likelihood that we're going to approve of or commit bombings overseas, maybe even less military spending down the line. We'll see.
Get that peace dividend. But let me try and summarize some of what we've talked about in a way that I think can help viewers understand the importance of sentiments, which is, these sentiments are really powerful. Our policymakers are drawing on them. We feel them to our bones. There's some things we're primed for, but the sentiments also will affect some of what the policy that we actually get, some of the government's actual behavior. These things ebb and flow, and we've got 340 million people in the country. A lot more people even have opinions about what the country does. And these sentiments are more emergent than something that one party or another dictates matters. And you're in the business of affecting people, trying to drive trying to draw on sentiments to convince them of some things, to give them something that's interesting. But because these are emergent phenomenon, it's really tough to tell how much influence you've had.
Yeah, I should say, this whole viewing it through the concept of sentiment, which is fascinating, is not necessarily actually how I'm thinking in my day-to-day work. And you may have, along this conversation, you may have shifted, you know, my Overton window, because, like, I can't deny that what you're saying is true. And the more you sort of delve into the notion of the power of sentiment, as I think this conversation has hinted, the more hopeless, you know, the task of ideological change in a libertarian direction seems. So perhaps I'm resistant to the idea a little. It's like, as you present it, it's like, yeah, of course, what you're saying is true. I mean, I'm a human. I have my own sentiments. I deal with other humans. I deal with them as humans in my life. I deal with them as readers. I deal with them, so it's depressing for someone who wants to make intellectual, ideological, and political change to hit the wall that, like, well, sometimes people just have feelings deep down inside. We don't exactly know how they got them. We don't exactly know how to change them. I think that statement is mostly true, and it's depressing, but I do have evidence, at least on the margins, that storytelling, arguments, helping people understand what government does, how it does it, helping people understand and see the ways things could be different. Because, like, a lot of libertarianism feels like political science fiction to people. It's like, okay, well, the government has been running public schools as long as I've been alive. I don't understand how education would work without them. And, you know, this is a cheap analogy. I'm sure I didn't come up with it. I got it from some other libertarian. I'm sure it's like, if the government had chosen, like, Mondani wants to do, of running the grocery stores all our lives, it was like, well, the government runs the grocery stores. I don't see how we're going to get food without it. But, like, we do understand that because markets have been allowed to exist in that world. And I think the more markets are allowed to exist, Bob Poole was great on this, the notion of, you privatize things around the edges. You don't necessarily have to convince every politician to accept the whole libertarian message. You just have to let more things be done by the private sector. And you have to have reasons for that that are kind of dollars and cents. And then people see, oh, this works. It actually works. It's fine that trucking is not as regulated as it was in the 70s. It's fine that airlines are not as regulated as it was. It's more than fine. It's great. It creates abundance and prosperity. And so the more you tell stories about not just government doing bad things, which is actually kind of my favorite because it gets your blood boiling, but stories about how markets, even highly constricted markets, create immense prosperity, immense greatness. There's a strain in the libertarian world, most of them call themselves left libertarians, who just really harp on the point. And it's true that nothing that happens in America is really free market. Like, government has its hands in everything and sometimes difficult to see ways. Yes, that's absolutely true. But to me, looking at what markets manage to create in terms of innovation and prosperity, even hobbled by government or even the other side of it, using government to their advantage in a way that I'd rather they not do. Despite those things, you just have to look, if you look at the world with open eyes, I don't see how you can hate capitalism the way that certain people claim they hate capitalism. And a lot of times, I think when they say that, I think they just hate certain results of the existing constricted capitalism that America has. And so it is helpful to point that stuff out, but I don't think we should lose sight of, we shouldn't just be like, oh, there's no such thing as free market, so you can't argue about the benefits of free markets. It's like, no, even though there's not much in terms of pure free markets, what we get from even the highly constrained free markets, I think, are a signpost to the wonders of free markets.
I wanted to go back to kind of your dourness about changing sentiments, because I'm actually a little more optimistic than at least you sounded at that point. So one of the theories is that there's this libertarian ideology that we think is true, meaningful, and would be beneficial to us all if we crafted our states based on these ideas. And part of the strategy was we just need to convince enough people of this ideology and then we win. And that hasn't happened. I mean, I don't know if there are more or fewer people who have those, who hold those ideas as true, important, and ought to be implemented than there used to be. I suspect there probably are more.
I'm confident there are more, but yes.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah.
But I also think that there's another aspect of, like, there are sentiments behind this. Again, like the ones we were talking about, the minimal violence sentiment that I think a lot of people do hold and that can be powerful in the right situation, the right set, the right opportunity. And I think there are probably more people these days, a lot more people who are going to resonate with those concepts than they used to. And that might matter in specific ways.
Yeah, I hope that that's true. And I act as if it's true. Is it like, you know, I wrote a book about the Burning Man Festival. It's a community that has strong streaks of anarchism, but also strong streaks of standard progressivism. And it's when I'm, and that's kind of my social world is largely formed of those sorts of people. And those are the people who I really try to play on that sentiment, that very abstract version of the sentiment. Like, yeah, don't we want the human world to work with the minimal possible violence? The possible becomes the word that you end up arguing about. You know, a lot of people think, well, yes, I agree with that, but thalidomide baby, so we have to have an FDA, and radio signals conflicting with each other, so we need an FTC, right? Certain people have a quicker little place where they go, well, the practicalities of this make me willing to give up on liberty. I happen, for whatever reason, to be what I'm not ashamed to call a raging ideologue for liberty. Like, I am willing to accept imperfections in the world were they to exist in a environment of total liberty. I'm willing to accept them, we don't have this one institution that's making laws enforced by violence and everyone. But that's my sentiment, right? And I have not yet been shaken from it, because I can and have been shaken on certain edge points of like, well, do you really think this is going to work out great if there were no, government courts? And I might be convinced, yeah, I see that that might be a problem. But I see all the problems that exist with government as we now have it, and I'm willing to risk that problem in favor of, you know, the mass destruction of resources, ruination of human lives, you know, wars, depredations, people grabbed on the streets, even like the pettiness of, you know, people being dogged by the IRS for some stupid paperwork mistake that's like ruining their life. I'd like to see all that go. And that is a big part of the Reason mission, as I said, the storytelling about, look at what your government is doing. Isn't this stupid? Isn't this destructive? And then the flip side is, and look at what people just doing things for other people in an attempt to make a buck. Look what that gets us. The combination of those two, I find super convincing, whether, you know, that's going to butt up against sentiment, or whether we can work that sentiment that we agree exists, that libertarian sentiment, make people kind of add some rationality to that sentiment to see what does that sentiment imply about should the government be doing this? In that sense, yes, sentiment can be a powerful tool. I find practically that, sentiment either runs up against a pragmatic sense that, oh, I just feel the world wouldn't work the way I wanted it to work if the government weren't building the roads or whatever, that those people are outside the realm of what I consider, liberty, whether it be immigrants, transsexuals, whoever the enemy of the day is. So it's tough. Like, it's a fight. You're never going to win every battle. Example, like, it feels a little contingent to me that Donald Trump happens to love tariffs and be against free trade. You could probably see the mentality of a businessman going like, well, you go and find the best deal you can. That's what you do. Like, that feels like Trumpian message to me. I feel like Trump, while still being Trump, could be like the big free trader around. And I think in a lot of ways, a lot of his fans, because I do think their attachment to Trump is a little pre-rational, I think he could turn a lot of his fans into free traders. So I'm not generally like a great man theorist in terms of history, but Trump is a clear example of one guy's crotchets and angers and prejudices really can sweep the country. And if there are people who like him, they're going to go ahead. And I saw the same thing with Ron Paul, actually. It's like a lot of people who definitely were not temperamentally libertarian along the way. There was some part of Ron Paul's message they really latched onto. And then they liked the guy. They liked his image. They liked the way he talked. They liked his consistency. And then they would start to think, and I run into this, interviewing dozens and dozens of Ron Paul fans. They would just say, well, if Ron Paul believes it, then I believe it because I've decided I like Ron Paul. And, you know, and that can be good if it's a guy who is as generally good as Ron Paul. It can be terrible if it's a guy as generally crummy as Donald Trump. And, you know, that is a whole other aspect of what we really didn't get into is the, you know, the leader principle. It's hopefully never going to be as important in American history as it has been elsewhere. But it's real. It's, you know, social change is complicated. There's a lot to it. Hopefully we've hit on some of the more important aspects of it.
There is a lot to it. And Brian, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.